Can I just grab the first question?
Go ahead.
I've heard you talk about this before, and I'd love you just to mention quickly the better translation of the word commandment.
Yeah. Yes. You know, we call them the Ten Commandments, but in the biblical text, they're not. It doesn't use that word. It uses the word "word." They're the ten words. Okay. Now, often that word. Word, am I being confusing? Often that is a term that's used for a prophetic word. You know, so a prophet speaks. The verb speak and the result is a word, a speech. So it's not a word for a commandment. It's a word for a prophetic word. So it's a word from God. And again, that takes us into the category of revelation rather than into the category of obligation. Although certainly revelation has intrinsic obligations connected to it.
Yeah, it might, in kind of organizational speak, it might be stuff like values and identity and mm-hmm. principles, mm-hmm. Governing principles.
Yes.
Okay, we'll just use the mic so we can hear what everyone can hear what the question is.
Professor, in the context of images and not making images and all that sort of thing, what do you think about wearing of the cross or a cross on top of the hill or a cross mm-hmm. on the church and all that?
I don't see why those would be any problem. Again, it's not like those crosses are serving as mediators, so that should not be any problem.
John, right at the very start, you said the way they talked about God and their world and the relationship with God, that the Israelites had themselves had trouble grasping that idea, and it took them 1,000 years before they really figured it out. And I'm just wondering what the start time of that 1,000 years and the end time was. And so are we talking like Moses is the start of that, and then...
Yeah, Moses is the start of it, and the return from exile is the end of it.
Yep.
That is, it's really not until... God abandons them, leaves the temple, Babylonians destroy it, Israel goes into exile, and they say, oh, now we get it, as they're sitting in Babylon. And then they come back and seem to have finally gotten it straight.
Mm-hmm. So when you describe, you know, like what it's like in the ancient Near East, like to me, that makes a lot of sense of then how the evolutionary scientists imagined that it was just a part of a survival process. Can you say something about that?
You know, in some of the formulations of evolution, and it's not inherent in it, but in some of the formulations of it, there's also the idea of evolution in history and human culture and psychology and all kinds of other areas. So evolution is not just biology. When it spreads, especially into those other areas, you get all kinds of ideas about how religion develops. And, you know, that often leads in some dangerous directions, because then you get people saying, oh, the Israelites couldn't possibly have been told there was one God back in the middle of the second millennium. Well, yeah, they could. It's just they didn't grasp it so easily. So... as time has gone on, more and more of those kind of rabbit trails, the side tangents, have been kind of shut down by further research.
I don't understand. A couple of weeks ago, you were saying that God revealed himself at their level for their understanding, yet he gave them an understanding that took them 1,000 years to grasp. I'm not understanding how that works together.
He revealed themselves at their level and in the context of their world. That's why he talks about idols and, you know, divine counsels and use of the name. This is all in their world. But theologically, he was calling them well beyond that world. See, I mentioned in things like cosmic geography or physiology, he stayed right where he wasn't revealing new things there. Theology, now he's revealing new things. And he's calling them well beyond that world and that way of thinking. And it was just very difficult for them to grasp. You know, it's even worse than trying to drive on the left side of the street instead of the right side of the street, which boggles my mind. Okay, yeah.
Do you think that the reform is destruction of statues
Okay, hold that question. The mic will come in a minute. Yes, we're back there with the mic.
John, thanks for what you've shared with us tonight. It's been very interesting. I have been waiting to hear you mention the word treaty and covenant.
Back tomorrow.
Okay, so the question is, you're trying to get us to think about the social context, the cultural context, and that's a topic that often comes up in relation to the law of Moses and particularly the Ten Commandments. Will we wait till tomorrow, or do you want...
Tomorrow, yes. Tomorrow we are going to be talking about those things. Indeed. And now up front here. So you can say it for everyone to hear now.
Do you think that the mass destruction of statues and icons during the Reformation was a misunderstanding of the Second Commandment?
Do I think that the destruction of icons and images... it really depends what they were doing with those icons and images. There are a lot of the uses of icons and images, Orthodox Church and Catholicism, respectively, which would not be a violation of the Second Commandment. But certainly they could be, depending on what people are doing with them. The Reformers, of course, were making a statement against the people they were arguing against, the Catholics and the Orthodox. I can't say whether those things were being misused or not. That misuse is not inherent in those religious systems. But we all have potential abuses of the Second Commandment.
I might just throw a comment in here and then continue with the other questions. Ian Proven developed somewhat similar ideas. You two guys are on the same page, and it's fantastic. But I came away, I think, with an enriched understanding of the way our entire worldview today is now so framed by Moses and Deuteronomy that we can't get out of it. Mm-hmm. And so I started to put forward the proposition, which I enjoy doing to people, that here's a test as to whether or not you really get how different the ancient Near Eastern world was. So the actual sentence I put forward said, if the sentence shocks you or confuses you, you don't get it yet. And so what I say is that atheism was only made possible by Moses and Deuteronomy, because it's actually a counter proposition that there is no God, which only makes sense once I put forward the proposition of God. Mm-hmm. It kind of annoys atheists, but their views were formed by God. But
another way of saying that same thing is that if you pull Moses and Israel out of the picture and just look at the ancient world, there is no atheism in the ancient world. Mm-hmm. That would be like saying there's no sun, moon, or stars. You know, there was no atheism in the ancient world. Okay, so in that sense, atheism as we know it is only possible with a God as we know him.
Yeah. It was a creation. It was what they call unintended consequence of Moses' work.
Yeah. You've got a question back there with some urgency.
This is related to the question from the front row. What about icons and images from non-Christian religions? If someone becomes a Christian, I remember reading much back in the 70s that Chinese people would then destroy these statues and images. For people who haven't come from that religion, is there an issue with pagan objects? Mm-hmm. For example, our art gallery here in Sydney is full of Buddhas. Hindu gods, etc. Mm-hmm. I just want your opinion on that.
Again, the main danger that this commandment is talking about is a danger in the world in which it was given, and that has to do with a particular use of images. Now, if images are being used as mediators for divine presence, revelation, etc., you need to get rid of them, because that's not acceptable. If images are being used to worship other gods, that's not acceptable either. Okay, and if someone's going to be a Christian, they can't keep worshiping their other gods through those images. Can they keep the images as somehow more innocuous, even though they have adopted religious practice of Christianity? Well, that's a more difficult one to call. Are they really going to be able to separate themselves from thinking of the images in that way? That would be the tough question. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it should be. It seems to me I've heard anecdotes of people who have had a problem with that, that an image that they thought purely innocent had some power connected to it, but I'm out of my field on that one.
Thanks, John. Just wondering, tomorrow, are you going to tackle the sacrificial system, because it comes to Exodus, Deuteronomy, just to give some ancient view to that to help us?
I can do so. It wasn't on my list of things to do, but it's something I talk about regularly enough, and I can try to squeak it in.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Thanks, John, again, for a very stimulating presentation. I've got a question that just springs to mind about the contrast between the images that they were used to, so the physical statues or idols or whatever, and then the idea that we as humans would reflect God's image and we should be those image bearers. A story, and this may not be the time to address it, but a story that actually comes to mind in the Bible where those two appear to be in conflict is that story where the Ark of the Covenant, which appears to be a very solid and indisputable image, is being carried, and a gentleman tries to support it as it falls, and he gets struck down. It sort of is kind of the image of God in human form versus the image in the more traditional form, and clearly the image in the more traditional form trumps. You see where I'm going with this.
Sure. The Ark of the Covenant does not come under the ban of images. Why? I mean, why is it that it could exist? Well, that's because for the Israelites, that did not contain the essence of the deity. The cherubs that are there are guardians of the divine presence. That's the role cherubs played. And the cherubs were not being worshipped, and the ark was not being worshipped. Okay, the cherubs were there guarding the invisible presence of deity. So that was not violating the image ban, because there was no essence of deity embedded in a manufactured object. Now, at the same time, the Ark was something. It was the most sacred relic that the Israelites had, and certainly the most sacred relic that Indiana Jones found. No. So this was a sacred relic, and as a result, they tried to use it to enlist the power of God, to commandeer God for their agendas. That's why Eli's sons take it into battle, figuring that this is going to help us win the battle. And of course it doesn't, and you know, other things are proven through that. But the idea of the ark is that it is a sacred object because it sits in God's presence at the center of sacred space. Now, when Uzzah, that poor fellow who caught the ark and was the last thing he ever did, when that happened, what's happening is that they're disrespecting the holiness of God. See, there were specified ways to transport the ark. And it was by the priests walking on their feet with the poles through the holes on their shoulders. Precisely so this kind of thing couldn't happen. But they had ignored those regulations and were doing it all their own way. And as a result, it was not image, you know, molded image versus human image. It was God's holiness versus human disrespect.
If I may shift to the Sabbath command, if that's all right.
The seventh commandment.
No, the Sabbath. Yes. Sorry, the fourth commandment, the Sabbath. I'd like to hear you say something a little more specific about the form of that commandment in Deuteronomy. You said some general things, and you mentioned that in Deuteronomy it's particularly remembering Exodus. Would you like to say something about why in Deuteronomy it takes that form in contrast to Exodus and what the significance of that might
be? I think it's very significant, especially because it really works within my interpretation of, so that's convenient. But in Exodus, it focuses on creation. You should do your work in 6 days, not on the seventh day, because God rested on the seventh day from all the work of creating. And I talked about that as having to do with God as the one who has brought order, God who is the one who is the center and source of order, and the Sabbath recognizes that God has brought order into the cosmos. In Deuteronomy, the form of it says, because you were slaves in Egypt and I brought you out and delivered you from your slavery. There it says you should honor God as the source and center of order because he has brought order to your society, your people, by giving you freedom. So both of them are the main examples of God's order-bringing activities. In one, he created the cosmos. In the other, he created Israel. And so that's how I would see them related.
There does seem to be a specific component to that. It specifies so that your male and female slaves or servants may rest along with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's also so that you can accomplish your own order-bringing activities in your own life by making somebody else do it instead of doing it yourself, and that's not supposed to be how it works.
So. John, you painted a picture of worship of pagan gods as one of a life of fear and oppression. Why do you think the children of God so quickly ran back to want to worship in that way?
Mm-hmm. Why did they so quickly run back? I think it's because they just couldn't adjust to the idea of a single God who didn't have needs, who worked the way that Deuteronomy and other scriptures says that he worked. They were so used to thinking in the great symbiosis way of thinking, in the way that the gods were within nature instead of outside of it. They were just so used to thinking that way. It was just a hard thing to break. You know, when you think of so many of the intrinsic cultural characteristics that we have as a society, whether it's modern society or Western society or Australian society or whatever it is, even if you recognize some things as not quite right, it would be difficult to undo them. You know, for instance, in America, and maybe here too, I don't know, but if in America we suddenly said, you know, we realize that consumerism is really wrong and we really shouldn't be a slave to consumerism, and so we're going to change that tomorrow. Well, good luck with that. You know, that's just not going to happen that way despite your best intentions, and you'd find your determination kind of sliding as the days go by. And it's the same kind of vicissitudes, vacillations that we see in Israel. You know, they'd get a good hard sermon about it, and they'd say, oh, we're going to do that different. And then, well, no, it just didn't pan out.
John, thank you. I wonder, you may be dealing with this tomorrow, but I wonder if you could comment on the relationship between the 10 words and the fact that Moses confronts the cosmology with the 10 plagues.
I'm not doing it tomorrow. And I don't know of any connection between them. I've never read anyone who tried to do that. They argue about whether there are 10 or which 10, how you number them and things like that, but no connection that I've seen.
I may be out of line here, but thank you for your presentation. For the unbelievers I see today, there's just, unlike the world of the ancient Near East where everything was religion, I see most people in Sydney Australia, to be the complete opposite. It's just this secular material world, and even a sense of the divine is just completely, it's just not an issue for people. Do you have any suggestions on how to bring forth these truths? Obviously, we have to get to Jesus, but is there anything else that Deuteronomy can help us in speaking to the preference to ignore the divine in our world today, or the spiritual?
I wish I did. Again, that's the, I tend to try to talk more to the church and help them recognize things they haven't recognized, more than I end up in situations where I'm trying to persuade the world that they're missing some important things. So there are other people that do those things rather well, but that's, I'm afraid I don't have a lot of suggestions.
Just make a little comment on that. It's a little bit of the unknown God in the Greek unknown God story there. I think there is a sense in which while they don't have a theistic religion, we've got to actually do a little bit more in challenging the beliefs that they have that inform the comments they make and the questions they ask. And I think it was Von Rad, I don't quote Von Rad very often, but Von Rad who actually made a very strong comment about the way in which the things that we instinctively believe inform the questions we ask. And I think that we've got to challenge the questions, the cynical questions from the secular majority in our nation, and actually sort of saying, are you thinking carefully or listening carefully to the beliefs that are informing the questions and the comments you're making? Because in a sense, they are a proxy for a religion. Mm-hmm. And we really need to tease that out so that the dialogue that I think you rightly draw attention to, that the dialogue can be a rich and I think constructive and a far more satisfying one for them, as well as less threatening, I think, for us. Look, I want to ask a question. we're inveterate moralists when it comes to the using the Bible. And if there's one area we get to moralising about particularly, it's the 10 words, the 10 commandments. That tends to focus on the last six. But it seems to me that the moral framework of being image bearers, of modelling our values on God and God's character, reflected more in these first four that you've covered, should be much more our focus when it comes to informing our moral framework. I'd really be interested in asking you, is that a line of thinking that you're comfortable with, or do you think that's risky too?
No, I think that's true. Especially three and four. No, really. Okay, in the first four, they want to tell us how we ought to be thinking about God and how he works in the world and how his power and authority work. And that becomes the foundation then for when you get to Commandments 5 through 10, which say, okay, now this is how you're supposed to work in the world. Remember, the whole idea of the law is that this is how what God's like, and so therefore this is what you're supposed to be like. And so it's always, our whatever moral ethical aspects are connected to our behavior always have to be drawn out of who God is. That's why the ancient world picture of God just simply didn't work. You couldn't make that equation. There was no way to make those connections. But for the Old Testament, that's the only way to think. This is not a sort of random or arbitrary moral code. This is behavior based on the character of God. And if our behavior, if even as Christians, if we turn our conduct code into just some sort of arbitrary list of rules, we're missing the point. One of the things when I teach Ten Commandments to little kids, it's to make the point that if you're just living the way you live because it makes life easier for you, or because there are authority figures that told you you're supposed to, or because there's a list of rules that you're told you're supposed to follow, you're missing the point. We live the way we live because of who God is. And that's why I don't like to use Bible stories with kids that tell them, so you ought to share and you ought to, be kind to your brother and sister and you ought to respect your parents. And yes, they ought to do those things, but wait a minute, before all of that, You need to know God, because our behavior needs to be driven by our knowledge of God. And if it's just behavior for some other sake, we're missing the point, because it's all got to be based on who God is. But I'm already thinking about my presentation tomorrow, and you're going to get a little more of that.